Hello and welcome to Leto Narrative Dissidence. This is episode 12 of season 2. We're talking about Tales from the Loop, role-playing in the 80s that never was. This is a role-playing game put out by Free League Publishing that is based on the artwork of Simon Stålenhag, who is a Swedish painter who is probably, you've seen his artwork if you've been on the internet any length of time. It is a very realistic style of painting. I would call it Trompe l'œil, sort of fool the eye photorealistic, but it is a juxtaposition of very realistic scenes of Sweden in the 1980s, but with impossible science fiction technology. So school children's walking by a giant robot in a field.
And occasionally dinosaurs.
And occasionally dinosaurs. Yes, that is true. It's not just robots. And so this role-playing game is about this idea of playing in a kids growing up surrounded by this impossible science fiction technology and amazing sights and scenes. It is extremely Spielbergian, I would describe it as. It uses the Year Zero engine, which is a system that the Free League have used for quite a few of their games. Of course, I have played some games of it on Role Playing Public Radio. So I have quite a few thoughts about this. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I'll take the night off.
Yeah.
Because I haven't played it, but I was fascinated by the book as a design object, which I will get into when we dig a little deeper. But yeah, it's a beautiful book, as you would expect from one based on the work of a painter. And de Stålenhag's art is, it's really cool. I mean, I just remember the first time I saw one of, you know, some kid whipping a snowball at a rusted out mega hauler that crashed in their backyard. And I'm like, this is, I love this juxtaposition. I love the frisson of the extremely mundane and the excitingly unusual. As you might guess from, you know, reading my work, is, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there where it's like, okay, here's how you jam the chocolate of weirdness into the peanut butter of everyday life.
There's an eeriness to a lot of the art as well. The art asks questions. It does not explain what is going on. It shows you this scene, and your first thought is, what? How did this come to be? What is that monolith in the background with all the lights on it? How are people not reacting to this stuff? There's a whole sequence he does of a technology that I don't think is referenced in Tales from the Loop, of people wearing what look like late 80s, early 90s VR helmets, which have clearly possessed them in some way or done them harm. It's hard. It's really hard to know. And there's clearly, one gets the impression that Stålenhag knows what's going on. But because a lot of this world is seen through the eyes of kids, kids just take this stuff for granted because it's what they've grown up with. So he and his narrators do not feel any need to explain. Yeah. The role-playing game, of course, because it has to explain this stuff because the GM has to know a lot of this stuff, does explain it. The other thing you didn't mention, Ross, is there was an Amazon TV series. There was a one-season series of Tales from the Loop, which were tales of kind of science fictional weirdness, often without a huge degree of explanation. It never quite caught on. It was interesting. It was, I don't think it quite knew what it was. It wasn't quite, there was a moment where there was some Philip K. Dick stuff coming out as well, and it was kind of slotting in with that, but it never found an audience. But it's interesting because the tone of that I found very different to the tone of the role-playing game.
Yeah, right. The series, I believe, was Amazon trying to chase after the Stranger Things market, and they didn't quite catch that, because Tales from the Loop, I think, is like a colder, like Stranger Things is very fond of the 80s. It is very, it loves the that and just having an adventure, and this is, I think, ambiguity and
ambiguity is the word, yes.
Yeah. There. I should also note there is a companion game, a sequel game, and series of artwork called Things from the Flood, which takes place in the 90s. And it, thematically, it's about the end of this impossible science fiction technology. Everything starts breaking and falling apart. The robots stop working. The magnetrine ships, the floating ships stop working. And there's no real reason. And that's a big mystery in the setting. I have that game as well. And it's about growing up and being disillusioned as a teenager. Like all the myths and things, all the fantasies you believed as a child. And, you know, you lose them as you become an adult. That's what it's about thematically. But it's, you know.
This is so fun.
Yeah. and the VR helmets, I think, are from that. I'm not sure, though. So there's all of it. It's in this exact same style. So it's hard to, unless you're really a close observer of Solid Hog's art. It's like, that's from Tales from the Loop. That's from Things from the Flood.
Forgotten the crucial upgrade that Things from the Flood made from Tales from the Loop. Is Things from the Flood. Almost the back cover. It doesn't quite say, now with character death, trademark. But it almost does, because in Tales from the Loop, children do not die. Kid can get scared, and they can get hurt, and they can even get broken, which I'm like, okay, that's as hardcore as you're going to get without actual, you know, oh, yeah. Your kid's just dead now, man. His parents are going to be really fucked up by this for the rest of their life. This is a fun game. So the fact that your character cannot die, I think, puts it in a very specific space. And we talked before the show, weeks before the show, when we were setting this up, Ross, it was you who described it as a kids on bikes game. And it definitely has that Stranger Things vibe. When I was, you know, answering our ongoing question, what does this game do? My notes are 80s nostalgia plus weird stuff with a bracing dose of the 80s were a little bit shit, actually, which is, I think, 100% the vibe of Simon de Stalenhag's art.
Yeah, that is 100% true. So that's what the game does. It is kids on bike, but you're also gradually becoming disillusioned about the world around you. As
your kids on bikes, but your bleak Swedish kids on bikes.
The game wants to emphasize that things are more complex. In fact, one of the than a simple Spielbergian adventure. Like it's more complex than E.T. Right? Like it's one of the character archetypes, the weirdo, you could say, what is the thing that is unique about you? What is special about you? Or what? No, it's what you're most proud of, is that you're you could be queer. You could be a gay kid growing up in the 80s, which is obviously
in the 80s.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, as someone who lived through the 80s, it's not all hairspray and leg warmers, listeners. It was in many ways a bleak, shitty time with a candy-colored coating layered on top by powerful commercial and political interests.
We should also know geographically the game takes place. There's actually two settings for it. One is the a series of the, I'm definitely going to mispronounce this, the Mallorca Islands outside of Stockholm in Sweden.
No, you nailed it.
Okay. And then Boulder City, Nevada, in the U.S. They created a new setting for it. So you know, us the Americans have something we can relate to, because it's not in America, we don't understand it. The U.S. setting text is actually written by Matt Forbeck, who has been designing games for a long ass time.
Fellow Beloiter. the man who's made it so that I am only the second most famous game designer in Beloit and the third most famous game designer from Beloit.
Yeah.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Greg Stafford.
So in the game, you will you form a group of kids. You sort of build out their personalities. They're what makes them unique and what makes them special. Then you go on adventures. It is very heavily emphasized in the game setting and in the rules that the adults can help you, but they're not going to solve the problem of the adventure. They're not going to solve the they're going to ignore the sci-fi thing happening. They're going to ignore the dinosaurs in the backyard unless it's absolutely necessary. So you're going to have to deal with the rampaging robots or the dinosaurs or whatever, you know, the transdimensional portal in the woods. And it's up to you to do this. And the game is about friendship and growing up and dealing with, you know, rampaging robots and transdimensional portals in the woods. I think that we sort of went over what it does. We should probably dive into how it does it.
Yes, which I think is going to be where we'll see if I'm wrong, but I think this is where we'll spend a lot of our time. It's mm-hmm. got very simple mechanics. They look serviceable to me. And you've played them, Ross, so I'll let you cover that. But basically, it's a dice pool, and you roll a number of six-siders, and if you get a six, that's a success. Most things only require one success. Something that's hard, two successes. Something like, I'm going to put the Velociraptor in a Brutus Beefcake stranglehold and choke that lizard right out. That's three successes. And so the scale of the system is not all over the place. And it makes me think, you're not going to roll a ton of dice here, but the idea that you could have this big handful of dice, it appeals to me because with you're just picking out sixes, man, that's not going to turn handling time into this monstrous thing. Okay, well, let's see, in this instance, fives and sixes are suggested, so I got it. And everything breaks down while you fiddle with the eight dice you had to roll. This isn't going to do this. This is going to be quick, and it's not picky.
Yeah, the basic roll stuff goes really fast, but then there are multiple things which allow you to re-roll, which I found, and I only played through one of the sample scenarios in the book with some friends. It was intensely annoying that it was roll a thing and... You know, oh, you don't make the roll. And it does, it has an interesting thing that if you don't make a roll, there are multiple mechanics that allow you to re-roll. There is luck, which plays a very large part. And there's a nice little balancing bit in character generation because your characters are between 10 and 15 years old. And that's how many points you get to put into your attributes, your age. But younger characters get more luck than older characters. So there's a balance there. That works quite nicely. But luck allows you to re-roll. Pride, you can attempt to stress a roll. I found
so
it.
So your pride that, you know what? I'm queer and I don't care who knows it. That's going to let
me. It's not quite. If you can bring in. Actually, is that a reroll or is that just.
Well, you have an item. Your item gives you a bonus dice on a roll. So like if your item is a skateboard. You're trying to get away from a robot that you get two bonus dice, and you can use that
right.
Whenever it's appropriate. But then you can use your pride once per mystery. It gives you an automatic success.
Oh.
So, once per adventure mystery.
And this is bringing in something that you are proud of personally, that, you know, that you, I can't remember the example in the rules, but
They have multiple examples. Like
let me see. So. I made a character, and what was my pride? My pride was I help others, and I didn't even know that I could use that once per game for a free thing. And I'm like, oh yeah, that'll come in real useful. This is going to make me popular with my fellow players. Is that once per session, if I feel like it, I can help you and automatically succeed. So.
Yeah, I do like one of the prizes, like for the bully or the tough kid, is that I helped an injured bird get back to health. Yeah, I thought that was very nice. So yeah, it's an opportunity for role playing to help flesh out your character as well. So that's linking mechanics to its themes.
I can't
quite
help
well, I think.
Picturing you know, people who will hold the treat above the dog's nose just out of reach and make them jump for it. It's like, you want your success? You want your success, boy? Role play for it. Role play for it, boy. Mm. Get the treat. Get the free success. And
yeah.
And yet, you know, the dog gets a treat.
the GM gets to see some role playing. So who am I to say that's bad?
Yeah,
it's not I haven't done similar mechanics.
Mm-hmm. No, it's just a sense that essentially from moment to moment the narrative will drop down to a mechanical level and come back up again. And some people are comfortable with that, and some people are less comfortable. The thing that I found really interesting about the mechanics, and I don't know how it compares to the rest of the Year Zero system, which I'm guessing because it devolves from or was originally created for Mutant Year Zero, is probably a fairly standard stuff. This stuff, the Tales from the Loop version, has literally no combat system. Mm-hmm. There is no specific way of fighting people. And if you do get in a fight, usually with other kids, you both describe what you want to do, you roll a dice, and that's the end of the combat. Mm-hmm. Combat is not so much downplayed as just written out. It's something that doesn't happen. And this is something I've been thinking about recently because I'm working on my Teen Detectives in a Fantasy World game again. And I had thought, again, you know, kids and young teens going up against adults, they're just going to lose, particularly in a fantasy world. But I would suspect also in a world where the physical setting is you live basically near to or literally above a very large top secret particle accelerator. There will be a large number of people whose job it is to wield weapons to stop you interfering.
And it's, you know, why would you want to choke out a velociraptor?
Well, there is the extended trouble mechanic, which is instead of like saying it's one and done for successes, you say when multiple players are trying to do something like say, you know, wrangle a velociraptor, all the players need three successes collectively to deal with this velociraptor. So everyone can make rolls until they together reach those number of successes. And that's basically it. So like, a collective thing. So like one player could, you know, roll something to distract the velociraptor. One could make a check to, you know, throw a stick at it. And then the other person grabs it. So, and there is the pushing the roll mechanic, which is if you fail, you can push a roll, but you mark a condition before you roll again.
Push. Yes.
Yeah. And
push was the other one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
And couldn't remember the name of
along there with is that. On page 70 a list of chance of success, like number of dice in your pool and what is your chance to succeed. And so like with you get in the 90%, it's like when you by the time you get to 7 dice and you push your roll, you're like a 90% chance of succeeding. So it's pretty easy to make a character who's very good at certain things, especially if you're willing to push. But when you mark a condition, you only have 4 conditions. And so when you get that 4th condition, you're broken, you're out of action until you recuperate. And this could be they have mechanics on how you do that, mostly going to someone you trust or talking to them, role playing a scene, or going back to your little base, your little hideout, your tree fort or whatever it is, and recovering. But yeah, that having played a couple other Year Zero games, notably Mutant Year Zero and Alien, this is a very simplified version of it. Yeah, it makes sense because in the rules you cannot die, and I actually really like that for a kids on bike thing. I think that's entirely appropriate and like should be like a ground zero. If you're doing a kids on bike game, you should state that from the forefront. If this is a game where kids can die or not. Because it's fine to do either one, but like everyone needs to be on board because that's such a touchy subject. Putting it in the text of the game is a good idea.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a cut down set of mechanics. It feels like something that's been thought through. I mean, if someone had said this has been designed from the ground up for this system, I'd have gone, well, you know, I think you could have done a better job with character generation, but the mechanics as a whole and the way it all integrates feels very complete. It doesn't feel like something that was compromised. There are no visible holes. It all fits together really nicely, and it fits the setting, and it fits the milieu. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I made a character, and it didn't take as long as it did in Eclipse Phase, and I'm sorry to and I'm sorry to yuck your yum, but I felt like I identified with my Swedish hick a little more than I identified with my uplifted ape anthropologist.
Oh yeah, I'm shocked at that. That does seem quite. No, I agree. I will say, though, one of the things I've learned about this system is actually, even though this is a, it is a, I wouldn't say not a rules light, but it is fairly restrained in the amount of mechanics it has. A lot of the book, most of the book is setting material, which we'll get into more. It's actually, like, you would think with these very rules you could explain in, you know, 15 minutes, characters you can make fairly quickly, that it would be a, and also with the genre, it would be a very easy game to teach people or introduce people to role-playing game. But in my experience, it requires, it distributes the load of role-playing pretty evenly among the entire group, which means, you know, a weak link, because a lot of the mechanics are emphasizing role-playing and, like, your relationships to each other and, like, how you relate to your family, your parents or your guardian and your siblings, if you have any, and adults that you trust. And so it can be a challenging game to play if you're not, like, used to role-playing, especially as a kid, because it's emphasizing you're a kid, you can't do certain things, you wouldn't want to do certain things, because, like, you're not like, well, let's go out and ignore school because we're going to go investigate the portal in the woods. No, you have to go to school and hope the adult, and just in your free time, go and investigate the portal. You got to, you can't be a, you know, it's not junior Delta Green agents, right? Like, you're kids.
That's the most horrifying concept I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And again, that's very Spielbergian, the sense that, you know, it's, there are these amazing things happening, but you still have to deal with the real world.
Yeah.
And adults are as much of an obstacle as the out-of-control robot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me jump into that with both feet, because I had a lot to... This spurred a great deal of thought on my part, is... And the text definitely supports the idea that you want to have this tension between the mundane and the fantastic. And I'm really into that. One of the designs I'm working on now, I've talked about in when I talk about scenario design in Dying Breath, which I'm working on, I'm like, okay, there are investigative scenes, there are action scenes, and then there are character scenes. And you never want to have two of the same type of scene back to back. And the reason for this is that it just feels like more of the same. If you have too many action scenes, none of them stand out. If you have too much character scene, scenery happening in succession, it feels soap opera. Like if you have too much investigation back to back, it gets dry. And so you want to constantly be changing it up. And I see a similar dynamic at play here in the fantastic versus the mundane. It was something I put into the first edition of Unknown Armies, and I talked about Scully's little dog from the X-Files. Anybody remember this? For a few episodes, Scully had this dog, this tiny yappy dog she was taking care of. And I'm like, yes, the mundanity of I need someone to take care of this dog while I'm away really threw the fantastic elements into higher, sharper relief for me. If you do not have these mundane moments of why are mom and dad fighting and why don't they want me to hear them fighting, the robot stuff is just, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's a game with robots. But if you have that family drama interlaced with it, now each of them reinforces the other, and each of them becomes richer because, you know, you defeat the rampaging robot, but it's like, okay, that's great. Is it really worth it if your family life is falling apart? Or alternately, it could be the fact that, okay, yeah, the only thing that is going to keep me going through my family life falling apart is the fact that I can be effective and make a difference and have control over something in this investigation, which now that I think about it, I'm like, well, that's Delta Green right there. Delta Green tends to play it more that, you know, okay, yeah, you are absolutely helpless against the mythos, my dude, but you can still make it to little Janie's soccer game if you want to do that instead of,
learning first aid so that you might save your buddy the next time he's bleeding out. But, you know, soccer matters too, doesn't it? So I'm very down with this. If I can go on an extremely 80s specific tangent, consider the band Van Halen. And in my mind, the interplay between David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen. And Eddie Van Halen was this very... Didn't he die? He died, didn't he? I know he was sick. Anyway, Eddie Van Halen, extremely technically proficient guitarist. David Lee Roth, larger than life, long blonde hair singer who could make the sentence, "I dropped my pencil," sound incredibly filthy. And the two of them together made this great, made some great albums. And then they broke up because you can't have the stolid guy and the flaky guy work together indefinitely, or can you? In this case, you couldn't. And I always felt that David Lee Roth kind of flitted off into the atmosphere because he didn't have the rest of Van Halen to hold him down. And the rest of Van Halen became, just a standard heavy rock band that sounded like standard heavy rock and became less fun because they didn't have the wild, colorful elements of David Lee Roth, cartwheeling over the stage to lighten them up. And so to me, the fantastic elements in Tales from the Loop are the David Lee Roth and the mundane, often quite dreary mundane mm-hmm. aspects are the rest of Van Halen holding that down. And, it gives you a key balance between frivolousness and gravitas. If you want to get really, really literary about it, this is Milan Kundera talking about lightness and weight in The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Damn. Reaching deep with that, Greg. There is sort of like a deepness to this game's philosophy because it's based on like Sondheim. I think you could see the influence of the arts philosophy in the game. Like, I mean, Sondheim was involved with the development of this game, and you can kind of see like the juxtaposition, I think, is key to this: the impossible with the mundane. Miracles next to just banality, and
miracles,
it's about this
next
contest.
To I got an Atari.
Yeah, exactly. One way or the other, I do really enjoy this game. I had a lot of fun running it and playing it, but there is part of me that resents which is again a very Spielbergian thing, which is like, oh yeah, these sci-fi elements, it's even though they literally exist in this world, they're just a metaphor for growing up. You're just going to discard them. As you grow up, they're all going to go away, and no one's ever going to talk about them or use them or think about them or build upon them or anything like that. It's like they never existed. Everyone acknowledges they existed, but no one's going to care. It's just like...
That does seem a little a little manipulative. Is that the word I'm looking for?
I mean, it's very much like the mainstream, like, I think, Kids on Bike message is that whatever you find, it was only for you and it helped you grow up, but it doesn't matter to the real world. Like, it's not going to change anything. Nothing's ever going to happen. We made first contact with aliens, but so what? It helped the kid get over being sad.
Yeah, and I mean, that's... when you phrase it like that, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of crap.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So did you feel that was in the text, or did you feel that was emergent from play?
It's in the text for sure. It's not, now to be fair, it's not very strong in this game. It's very much a minor note. In the sequel game, Thanks for the Flood, it's all about that. It literally every single piece of sci-fi thing in Tales from the Loop starts decaying, rotting away, going away, disappearing mysteriously in Things from the Flood. The robots start breaking down. The machines start breaking down. Everyone stops using this technology in exchange for conventional technology.
you know, the technology we all are all familiar with, you know, the internet, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the very obvious text of that game. Well, so that's why I didn't run. I run like one session that I was like, yeah, I'm done. I don't care about
the Magnetrine freighters were extremely cool. Nobody disputes that, but they couldn't bring porn straight to your house. Now, could they?
I mean, well, they literally come with multiple Deus Ex Machinas in Things from the Flood saying like, oh yeah, the poles reversed, the magnetic poles reversed. And so they stopped working.
In South America. Or the global South with the Magnetrine.
No, they're gone. They none of them work anymore.
It's not like Tales from the Loop doesn't have many Deus Ex Machina itself and its background. It's like, okay, suddenly, okay, 1943, somebody essentially invents anti-gravity. Mm-hmm. And then sometime in the 60s, somebody invents robots that work.
Yeah.
And these do not have particular kick-on effects to the rest of technology. And I bang on about this. I'm sorry. I banged on about it with Coyote and Crow, but in Lancer as well. If you introduce one world-changing technology, it changes the world.
Mm-hmm. Bang and, you know, on, James. Do it. Give it to us.
It's it explains what a lot of the things in the Stellenhag pictures are in a very concrete way that I was kind of this isn't a magic world with weird stuff floating around. It's just an alternate history. Mm-hmm. And I was profoundly disappointed by that. And I think I enjoyed the weirdness of the Amazon series where inexplicable things do happen a lot more than this, where it turns out a lot of the inexplicable things are actually quite explicable given the terms of the world as it's set up. Yes, there are bizarre robots in the woods, but that's because there are robots everywhere and, you know, people make their own or fix them or they wear out.
There are also bizarre robots at the gas station.
It's, I don't know. I felt it was lacking in a sense of wonder. Yeah. I ran the sample adventure. I'm not going to give spoilers for it, but it's the one with the birds. Okay. And it's clearly an homage in some ways to Hitchcock's The Birds. But it starts off, the very first encounter is the birds have acquired a degree of intelligence. Let's put it that way. And so we had this encounter. We'd done a few things, established the characters, and they're sitting there, and there's pigeons knocking around, you know, looking for food. And so one of them chucks them some biscuit crumbs or something. And the pigeon spots it and goes, oh, and that was a magic moment. The player's expression as the pigeon spoke was the best thing in the entire adventure.
Mm-hmm. That.
The rest of it, once they started to, you know, work out, it just became a role-playing adventure.
Mm.
But just the moment of, my God, did that pigeon talk? It talked. Was really lovely. And that, I had this lovely moment of this is going to be great. And then it wasn't somehow. You follow trails of clues and talk to people some of whom are a bit weird and some of whom just don't tie in. Mm-hmm. And I was disappointed with the scenario construction. A lot of the scenario seeds and samples just don't seem to buy into the weirdness. They're weird, but they're not Stellenhag weird.
There is a adventure book called Our Friends the Machines, which I did run several adventures of, and my players quite liked it because, like, the first one, the title scenario, Our Friends the Machine, which is about a new line of action figures, toys that take a turn of the weird. You know, they're basically Transformers, but they're alive. So, they're tiny little robots running around, and of course, one of my players, Aaron, is a huge, you know, fan of Transformers and talking robots in the kids on bike genre in general. And so, you know, we all just, oh yeah, you're a talking robot. You're a little toy robot that talks to us. You're our new friend and we will die for you. Like they just instant, like, the whole thing became, we have to protect our toy robot, that can talk. And
what's that Joe Dante movie? Small Soldiers?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Small Soldiers. Yeah. Basically. You can have a lot of fun with this game. There are a lot of adventures for it. It looks like they're actually putting out a new set of adventures for it pre-order that grow up so fast. the four adventures that form a campaign spanning the seasons of a year. When an ordinary camping trip turns to something else, they are discovered that your friends come in all sizes and forms, even from different worlds. So it takes place in the UK, Norfolk Broads.
Bizarre. This is going to sound like something I've just made up. Yeah. My brother-in-law is the Member of Parliament for the Norfolk Broads, as it happens.
Yeah.
That's completely true. Yeah. That is completely true.
To me, the Norfolk Broads sounds like a pictorial you don't want your wife to know you've seen.
Hey-o.
Yeah, lad, you're looking for a good time. No, the Norfolk Broads is an area of low-lying... East Anglia, generally Norfolk and Suffolk, is old seabed. It's very low-lying. The Broads are an area of wetland and water ways, basically.
Mm.
It's quite remote, but actually it's only about 150 miles from London. It's really not that far at all. But yeah, it's an odd area.
There is a lot of the book that describes on how to run a mystery and how to set it up, how to like structure the clues and like branch out so players have a lot of choices and investigate. Because at heart, this is an investigative game, right? Like there is they call adventures mysteries and you have to solve the mystery, you know. It's very lighthearted, you know, because again, kids on bikes.
I mean, if you want to go into the full Scooby-Doo thing, James, you were talking about doing a kids on bikes or kids on brooms fantasy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Like, if you want to go the full Scooby-Doo, they can only overcome, you know, you can never win in combat. You can only run away unless you build an elaborate trap.
But I think like the strength of this game obviously lies on the adventures, right? Like, I mean, in the sense, this is like called Cthulhu or Delta Green, in that like the core of this game is running interesting adventures and interesting mysteries, and to hit that sweet spot of being like satisfying to solve and unravel, but not being like something that would not be in this genre. Like nothing like, oh, you have to go into this abandoned warehouse and take down a group of hardened cultists guarding the, you know, the weird machine they're using. Like that doesn't make sense. Or like, and that's what I think, again, this seems like an introductory RPG, but it does like demand everybody be on this sort of very particular wavelength of like what is appropriate for kids on bike and what is not. And if these published adventures don't work for you, the game isn't going to work. But I do remember Our Friends and Machines being a pretty solid adventure anthology.
Let me talk about Tales from the Loop, not so much as the mental construction of its rules and text, and more as a positioned product slash objet d'art, if you will, because this started for me, my analysis of it, in this fashion, kind of arose from noticing how thick the pages were. I'm like, oh, these are some luxe pages. This is thick pages. And then I'm like, well, and you know, and the book's gorgeous, and it showcases De Stolenhag's art really well, and it is. James, layout, good layout, lots of white space, big fonts.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah, the
page is just... It's a gorgeous book. And looking at it as a product, I'm like, this feels like it should be a huge, complicated, deep setting with all this stuff. And then you look at it, it's not even 200 pages. And if you compare it to Planet Mercenary, and I've got the two of them right here, Planet Mercenary is actually probably about a centimeter thinner, but Planet Mercenary is, how many pages is this bad boy?
I think it's around 350.
You are exactly right. It's 350 and it's tiny text and there's not a lot of white space. And so...
And its columns aren't balanced, as I recall.
And it's cut. Also, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to put it in my late-night jazz DJ voice, because you've heard it so often in my voice, but listeners out there in radio land, this uses the future conditional tense. You'll find that it's not really bad in Tales from the Loop, but it pops up enough to really make me feel bummed out. So it happened.
I think that that's actually an interesting comparison, Greg. And I think, like,
well,
looking at the con,
I'm going on. I've got, there's more layers.
all right. Sorry.
This coincided with an RPGNet thread on what are the parts you skip over in rule books. And I read that and I'm like, a lot of what people are citing as things they skip over are the stuff I've done my career doing. You know, the actual things that I get paid to do are the stuff that are like, no, that's filler. I don't read the short fiction. I don't read the settings. I don't read all the mechanical examples. And as I'm reading this, I'm like, if you gave me this thread as a design brief, the only thing I could turn in is a blank page.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everyone skips different stuff. And RPGNet, God bless it. I love it. But it is not a place for casuals. If you, it is a self-selected group of people who care more than average about their role-playing games.
Yes, so, many of whom have been arguing about it for around 20 years.
It's true. So if you are in the demographic that, for this.
Oh, yeah, some of them more. I would say on average, 20 years, I think.
I will say if you are in the demographic for this podcast, check out RPGNet because you probably find something there that perks your interest. But in the light of that thread, I'm like, okay, so instead of building a world based on words and concepts and people and places and technologies, the way most role-playing game settings are built, the way I build them, this was built on a series of image. And I'm like, is this all just vibes? Vibes and tone? And I'm like, okay. And this seems like a book that a lot of people would get and feel that it was a good value for their money. And I'm like, but it tells you much less than, page per page, than Eclipse Phase or Lancer or many of the books we've read. What was the other one I was thinking? A Planet Mercenary I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that's bad, because if you buy this, you are probably buying it because the art sucks you in and you're like, yes, I want that vibe. And if you're one of those players who's like, I skip over the fiction, well, how much setting do you really need when you have the vibes?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure that for a certain segment of the market, like, they're like, yeah, this is the game. I know exactly the feel of it just from looking at the cover and the pictures and, you know, glossing over what character generation's like. I got it. Okay, I got it. And I'm like, I hate it. I hate that it's this way. This is clearly not for me. I need a giant pile of details and a rich backstory and, you know, give me huge piles of stuff. But my better self is like, well, Greg, you're not the only kind of gamer there is. And there are people who do not need, nor do they desire, big piles of stuff. So it has given me an insight into how the other half lives. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm trying to say with this, other than this is a different approach to presenting a setting. Mm-hmm. And whereas most settings will describe every brick in the wall because they know the bricks are there, Tales from the Loop is more impressionistic. And it's like, oh, yeah, with three lines and two swoops of paint, I can show you, I can do something that looks where, you know, you're like, yeah, that's brick wall. And you don't care about every brick, so why should I describe every brick? Is this just me being weird, or am I onto something
here? No, not at all. I mean, I think it's got the big piles of stuff, but the big piles of stuff is the Stellenhag artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, it's artwork that raises questions rather than answering them. And while I have a lot of respect for what this system does, and it's perfectly serviceable, and it you know, does what it says on the tin, I would have gone, if I'd been brought in on this, or if I decided to run it as a homebrew for friends, I'd have done it in a very different direction. And I would have, you know, held up pictures of the robots and gone, what's this one called? What does it do? Where do you see it? Why? How do you feel about it? Is it scary? Is it friendly? Do different kids have different reactions to it? Because there's no sense in the book, they just kind of presented as technology, a lot of them, that you just kind of accept they're there. There's no sense of myth to them. I, when I was a kid, was quite a young kid, I was obsessed with combine harvesters. And I mean, fantastic, you know, involved, complicated machines, and the wheat goes in at one end and the straw comes out at the other and the grain comes out in another, and there's dust and there's two or three people around, and then the straw is picked up into a baler and it's turned into bales, and it's just, if you're six or seven, it's fantastic. If those had been autonomous, I would have been obsessed and terrified by them. Mm-hmm. And they weren't, because, you know, this was some decades ago. But that, to me, is what I didn't get out of the kid. I didn't get how the kids react to this technology, because most of them seem to regard it within the book in the same way that they would regard their parents' car. It's just kind of there. The loop, it's never really explained what the loops do, and there are two loops. There's the North American loop, and there's the Swedish loop, and they are twinned in some way, and that's never really made clear. Yeah. And, you know, the kids do not build up any kind of mythology. They don't tell each other stories about what's going on in this world with the weirdness. And it is a weird world, because there's talking pigeons, the first adventure, talking pigeons. And the kids are just, other than that moment of, oh, they just kind of went in and, oh, yeah, you know, we'll solve the mystery of the talking pigeons and the talking seagulls and the rest of it. I think, for the RPGNet audience, and I think for people who have seen Stellan Hag's artwork and are vaguely aware of role-playing games and might have played some D&D, Tales from the Loop is the role-playing game they need. But I think they could have been bolder, they could have gone further. And obviously, the companies, they're setting up a franchise, they're doing stuff with shared mechanics, they're building up and have built up a fantastic line of really well-produced games that, you know, almost second to none in terms of the thoughtful quality of the production. And, you know, the Alien game has blown down doors in terms of sales, in terms of, you know, getting a license absolutely right in the last few years. It's one of the ones that you have to hold up and go, yes, absolutely nails what is a lot of people a really, really important property, you know, and mental space within their understanding of science fiction as a genre. So I can understand entirely why they didn't do that, but I think there's a really interesting role-playing game that could have been done within the Stellan Hag space, and I don't think this is it.
James, surely you're not suggesting that the most daring...
They should hire me?
What?
That they should hire me? No.
No, I was going to say...
I mean, it wouldn't sell. It would sell maybe 500 copies, tops, but they'd be to the right people. And people would, I think, have campaigns within that, or at least series of adventures that would be at least I'm going to say the kind of stuff that I would really enjoy, the kind of storytelling that I hope would stay with people rather than stuff that's just a bunch of role-playing adventures. But you yourself used the phrase earlier on, don't yuck on someone else's yum. Mm-hmm. People love this game, with, you know, rightly so. It does a really good job of giving you taking that amazing Stellan Hag artwork and turning it into a ludic environment.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, are you suggesting that there is some kind of tension or conflict between the demands of pushing an art form forward and the demands of commerce? Because that just sounds... What?
Did you just describe Hogshead Publishing, the later years?
Not intentionally. I'm sorry. I picked that scab for you, bro.
That scab has scarred over long since.
Yeah, no, it is a different approach to how do you describe a particular setting in a role-playing book versus like earlier games, right? Like it is very, it's like the painting's impressionistic. Like it is enough of the setting for you to sort of get the vibe and then go from there, because I think that's what they've decided to do. Like I'm looking at their store page, and Tales from the Loop is entirely, all of the supplements are adventure anthologies. They are only doing adventures for it. So in a sense, it's a lot like Call of Cthulhu, right? Like it's very adventure focused in different areas. Like they're going to England, like the UK, you know, different themes about it. So
looking at the vibes.
Yeah. But looking at the table of contents, if you look at the table of contents, it's 12 chapters, you know, divided into four sections, really. Like the first is the intro, the first three chapters, you know, Welcome to the Loop, the Age of the Loop, the U.S. Loop, basic setting stuff, like the most important concepts. Then you have the game itself, making characters, you know, the basic system rules, and then how to do a mystery, like advice on how to set up a mystery. Then the next three chapters are just setting stuff, you know, the landscape, the four seasons of Mad Science, and then the remaining, actually four chapters of the book are all adventures. So instead of doing like, here's a bestiary of robots, right? Here's a bestiary of dinos and talking birds and whatnot. They're just saying like, you get the idea that this stuff is all possible. Here's an adventure about this monster. Here's an adventure about this. Here's an adventure about this. And you can choose, mix and match whatever you want for your campaign to be true. Because I think in their eyes it's all possible, but whatever you want for your table. Because I think a lot of tables, maybe they don't want the talking birds, they just want the robot stuff. You know, like our table was very focused. Oh, talking robots, you say. Well, yes, we'll befriend all of them and save them from destruction. And, you know, my players wouldn't have cared as much about, you know, talking birds. So I think it's just kind of a generational difference of like how you take the content of a role-playing game and structure it. In this case, it's all adventures. It's a very simple system to pick up, and then you just focus on the adventures.
You don't need a bestiary when it's a player-facing system where most things are, oh, you need to beat one, and a hellish, awe-inspiring challenge is, oh, you need to beat three.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also they don't explain the mystery of the loop because they're... In some ways, it's probably a generational like reaction to things like the World of Darkness, where like we have a meta plot, fuckers, and like that it doesn't matter what you do. Cain and the Antediluvians are behind everything, and nothing you do matters. And so,
get in the car, kid. We got a meta plot.
Yeah, we got a meta plot, and you're going to be watching this meta plot and not doing it. So like, this is the opposite reaction. There's kind of a setting, but whatever you want to be canon is canon. And that's it. Like, whatever the mystery of the... Does it matter if the mystery of the loop has a canon explanation? Or is it whatever you want it to be in your game?
Is it going to be relevant for your kids?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's... It's a different style. And it's a generational thing, at least in terms of games. I see it a lot in games now.
I was just expecting it to take more of a place, given that it's in the title.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm absolutely with you on meta plots and big stories, big secrets that you don't tell the players. I published Slay Industries for a while in the 90s, which I don't know if you know the secret behind Slay Industries.
I read it on RPG.net. Yeah, but
yeah, it's if you're listening to this podcast, you're the kind of person who would know it. Essentially, Slay Industries and all the other games that the same company was going to release all take place in the minds of people in an insane asylum.
Oh, I never knew that one.
Yeah, okay. It's that that secret.
Is it multiple people or is it just one person?
Slay is in one person's head, but there are multiple people within this essentially asylum.
Okay.
And each of them, and they've been treated with a drug and... and that got out at some point, and people were like, the fuck? Mm-hmm. And it did not go well.
I gotta say, people may have had a point there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, GMs and players will come up with a big secret. If you want a big secret, let GMs and players come up with their own, because they may not come up with a better one, but they will come up with one that is better suited to them mm-hmm. and
which
to the sort of campaign
better.
They want. Mm-hmm. And they may, in some cases, come up with a better one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, the best meta plot in the world that is not relevant to your players is not a good meta plot for you.
Mm-hmm. No.
I mean, yeah, it's like, oh, cool. 90% of people love it and I hate it. This is a bad buy.
Yeah. You know, now that I think about it, I think Tales from the Loop is a good intermediary RPG. I don't think it's like a beginner's, your first RPG adventure, because if you're not used to being playing someone who is not you, like even if you're like trying to play a kid version of yourself, that could be a little hard for very new players to get into. Like that, people get nervous about it, I think. Or it's very common for that to happen. Also, running a mystery investigative game is a little more challenging than like a basic like dungeon crawls work, because it's like, all right, what room do you go to? Okay, well, there's orcs. Then I guess we're going to do a combat because they don't like you. But rolling a mystery requires keeping an eye, like the GM has to like think about things that are happening outside of the character's perception. Like, you know, people react and things happen off screen. But like once you're used to those very basic things, then maybe you can move up to Tales from the Loop and like, oh, now we're kids. We're having our own Spielbergian adventure. You know, it's going to be fun. It's going to be Stranger Things. It's going to we get to talk to robots or birds and like have a good time. And then you can move on to, you know, more very challenging games, depending on what your perception of, you know, challenging is, like what aspect rules you. But I think, so
the Morrow Project.
Yeah, because again, like I think. Yeah, the Morrow Project, or like even Delta Green, which is a very challenging game to run and to play because, mm-hmm. Or games with very complex, whatever it is.
How about Continuum?
Yeah, well, that's not a game. You that is a exercise in absurdist comedy, and I will not hear arguments to the contrary until someone can show me a full game of Continuum played rules as written. I don't believe it can be done. I'm happy to be corrected, but show me the proof. Show me a game of it. it actually involves you to see into the future to run, so I don't see it's possible. So that's what I think about Tales from the Loop. I think it's a great medium system, and the strength of the adventures is what will sell you on it, unless you're really good at writing your own mysteries. Which it does give you good, solid advice on with like really good.
Oh, it really does. So. Yeah. How to diagram out an adventure, a mystery adventure is really, that could be a supplement on its own. And I'm sure somebody has done it and is selling it busily on DriveThru right now. But it's just, it's really simple. It's really straightforward. It hits all the notes really nice.
Yeah. The graphic design really helps it too. Like it is actually a really easy book to read. Like the way it approaches information design lets you really pick up an adventure quickly and get into it. It's very concisely written for that. So I applaud it for that as well. So in terms of, I guess we're already on how people play it.
Do people play this? Because my notes are, how do people play this? I don't know. Are people really doing the everyday life divorcing parents plot lines? One thing I noticed is they tell you, oh, you got to have this back and forth between the mundane and the fantastic, but they don't tell you why. And I think that more people would do it if they explained that if you have the mundane well established, it makes the fantastic richer. And if you have the fantastic well established, it makes the mundane meaningful. That when you have a fantastic scene, it shows the importance. But, well, I don't even know if it shows the importance. It shows something magnificent and fantastic and fascinating and a spectacle, but unless you have those mundane moments, it's harder to care. It's harder to care about the people experiencing them.
Yeah.
And again, this is something that Spielberg does absolutely brilliantly, not just from E.T., but Close Encounters, you know, the final stakes, you know, do you stay home and look after your family? Do you go off with the aliens? Poltergeist as well I talk about Poltergeist too much. It spends a very long time at the beginning just establishing what is normal. Very little happens at the start of Poltergeist for quite a long time. And Everything Everywhere All at Once then does exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. There almost nothing happens for the first... I mean, there's amusing moments and there's jokes and stuff, but it's character establishment. It's establishing everybody's normal lives. So when the weirdness comes in, it is that much weirder. And it also, it tells us what the stakes are. And yeah, I mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once. At some point, I'm going to have to sit down and actually diagram out the structure of that just to see how it does.
I still haven't seen it. I keep meaning to, and I haven't seen it. Everyone
deserves those Oscar wins, I'll tell you that.
It really
everyone tells me it's this great, great, great movie. And so,
It is not like anything else.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very, very cosmic level Unknown Armies, too, in a way.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I would actually say, well, the game does mechanically, like, aid you in going from the mundane to the wondrous through, we mentioned, like, there's a hideout where you can go and, like, recover a condition. But you also have the anchor, which we haven't mentioned yet. Everyone has an anchor, which is... in the game, a person that you can go to for support, comfort, and care. A friend, a parent, a teacher, or a neighbor. It cannot be another kid. If you suffer from one or more conditions, you can spend a scene with your anchor and heal all conditions. You must allow the anchor to take care of you, and there must be physical or mental closeness between you. The GM is not allowed to put you in trouble in this scene. If you put yourself in trouble, you don't heal any conditions. I remember, like, one of my players in the game, the RPPR games, was a horror movie fan. And so his anchor was like the video store clerk that, recommended horror movies to him. So there were role playing scenes where they're talking about horror movies and like the clerk was providing advice and that kind of thing. And it made for really nice moments. And, you know, there are other scenes, you know, the game does sort of like, oh yeah, before you do this, have a scene of your mundane life. And the role playing stuff or the relationships between you and the people you know in your life can help inform scenes. And it just kind of happens like, well, we need to take the robot somewhere. Oh, well, my dad's garage workshop. Oh, shoot. Now we need to distract the dad so he doesn't come in and see the robot. Because you have to flesh out your character and who they are in the community, it kind of allows for a lot of opportunities to sort of naturally flow into each other. But there are some mechanical hooks to enforce mundane, well, not enforce, but like help bring the mundane back into focus. So it's not all, you know, talking robots and birds and time travel and trans-dimensional portals and whatnot.
Man, you know what, know what else does had this balance between the mundane and the fantastic was early issues of the comic Love and Rockets.
And oh, yes.
So you would have just bizarre stuff. And then, you know, the next page, it's like, oh, yeah, we're going down to the corner market to try and buy beer with a fake ID. And so, you know, just another data point there.
Yeah. I think once you're a little used to role playing, like, or even if you're very experienced, this would be not just intermediate, but experienced are, you know, gamers as well. I think you just need a little bit of familiarity with the concept of role playing in order to like make the most out of this. Is really my only critique of that, and that's it because this game does so much in so little, it doesn't provide maybe as much hand holding as like absolutely new players need, which is maybe a bit deceiving because like the game seems like a perfect thing for an introductory thing, but like Kids on Bike is actually kind of a tricky genre to run in my experience, because you have to balance the lightness and the mundane with the fantastic and the serious and dark stuff.
The absolute easiest game to teach people that we've talked about is probably Morkborg.
Yeah. Mm, you know what you're getting into, and everyone's into heavy metal stuff.
Yeah. Just freak your shit, man. There's no weighty emotional content to process and digest. You're just gonna wild out.
Well, you know, honestly, one of the games that I've had pretty introducing new players to RPGs is actually Red Markets, because everyone gets you have to pay your bills, and you have to do unpleasant things to pay your bills. So that kind of works. But yeah, that's another, that should be a topic for a future episode, like how to introduce people to RPGs.
Is the best first game?
That's a weighty subject. But this is like, if you have a little bit, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you already have the experience. So this is read through some of the descriptions. Like, there's four adventures in the core book, and there's like multiple supplements now that are just adventures. Our Friends the Machine, I had a lot of fun with that. There's some actual plays in RPP or actual play, but it's a surprisingly deep system for the lightness of the rules. But like, and you could totally ignore like the very depressive, like, oh yes, all this wonder technology is just going away eventually, and it's just for your eyes, and the adults are ignoring it. You could just like, oh no, robots take over.
By the time you've stolen your first beer, all wonder will be absent from the world.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's a land of rich contrast, a rich tapestry for sure.
So you're really pretty down on Things from the Flood, huh?
I hate that trope so much in movies and stuff like that. Imagine possible thing that you found that you've had this whole adventure about, you know, like I really hate that, like the kids in Narnia like just leave the closet and grow and just are normal. Like, I don't like that idea of like, no, they were forever changed, or they're gonna bring that back with them. There are effects with it. If there is an impossible thing, then it's obviously not impossible, it's possible. And also, like, you know, if you read about the history of science, people, you know, there's simultaneous discoveries, you know, there's multiple cases like, oh, it's not just this one person in this one area discovered this one thing, and if not for them, we would never know about this scientific principle. No, there's like cases like, oh, there were like three other teams around the world that were like a few months
steam
behind.
Engine time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
For listeners at home.
Telephones.
Unfamiliar with the concept, steam engine time. Someone noticed that about three different people invented the steam engine contemporaneously without knowing about each other's work because it was steam engine time. It was the time when this development of using steam force to create mechanical effects went from being a really wild idea that you had to be a genius to have to being a pretty accessible idea that you only had to be kind of clever to have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the associated technologies were there, and also the need. Mines were flooding. We needed more efficient ways to pump the water out of mines. Mm-hmm. Even before railway engines. Yes. So,
yeah. If they're talking birds in one particular neighborhood in Sweden, there would be standard reason. They're probably going to be talking birds somewhere else along the lines. So like, or someone else is going to figure out how to make birds talk, figure that out. It just seems contrived. If you already have one impossible MacGuffin in your setting, why is it just limited? Again, pet peeve. And you can totally ignore it for your game. Like, it, as a way of running kids on bikes, you could totally
found ignore. Ross's future conditional tense /unbalanced column button. Yeah, found it.
This science fiction or fantasy thing is not a metaphor for your own personal struggle. If it exists in the world, it would have ramifications for the world, all right? It's not. Yes. I see it so much in science fiction. And
join us, Ross. It's bliss.
Yes.
The third hobby horse of the game design apocalypse has been found.
I think we've covered, are there any, again, it's a really fun game. Listen to our actual plays on RPPR. And the adventures, at least Our Friends of the Machine, are quite fun. So if you want a kids on bike thing and you don't want to use monsters and other childish things, obviously I love that game since I've written for it. If you want to go in more robots versus you have a demon for a friend, this is a great way of looking at it. And they're beautiful books, fun to read.
Yeah,
they're not, and they're quick reads too. Like I said, it's like less than 200 pages. So I highly recommend it.
It's less than 200 pages, yet it feels like 390.
It's a good feel for the book. Yeah, it's really a high quality book.
It will take up an attractive space on your bookshelf, probably next to Blades in the Dark. I think it's the same size.
No, Blades in the Dark is like 6x9, and this is like full 8.5x11.
Is it?
Yeah,
I'm sure. Blades I would swear I'd seen a smaller copy.
Yeah.
I could.
Oh, are you reading it on in PDF?
Yes, I typically read things in PDF these days.
Yeah.
See, I prefer the physical, tangible object, and that's why I noticed sort of the way it had been made. Mm-hmm. So.
No, I've seen physical copies, which is why I'm surprised to hear that it is full size. But no, most of my shelves are double stacked already with books lying on top of other books as well. I was just looking at the shelves in my living room. There is a noticeable bow. They are weighed
Sounds
down.
Sounds to me like someone needs new shelves.
I think you're probably right. Or needs to move house to somewhere more storage.
Or do a good old book purging.
Shut your mouth! Heretic.
You can give them to your friends. That's how you do it. You can borrow that. Go ahead. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
They won't appreciate them the way I do.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much for listening. Before we go, I would like to thank Sky DeBover, who I believe is a RPPR patron and longtime listener. Thank you so much for backing this season of Letter Narrative Dissidents. I hope you enjoyed this episode.
And I will add my thanks to Arc Dream Publishing as a backer, who have brought so many good things into my life. Most recently, the yellow sign.
So in our next episode, is going to be another game mechanics focus episode where we're going to be talking about diceless systems. And I believe one of us has had a little experience in that area. Just a slight a bit. Is that right, James?
More than a little, yeah.
I look forward to that.
Been there, done that multiple times. it's a pet subject of mine. I will probably talk more in that one than I did in this one. I apologize. Technological
Which
reasons.
Is acceptable. I think it must be hard for a British person to grasp how attracted Americans are to an accent. So,
I should ration it out, is what you're saying.
There you go.
No, man, we need to get those listeners. Just blare it out.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.